Welcome to Christ and College, Keeping and Sharing the Faith by John Calvin Young, a production of Great Waters Press. See us on the web at raisingrealmen.com.
Lord, thank you for this time we've got today to talk about how to serve you, particularly during this really difficult time of transition and time when many young folks see the worst opposition they're ever going to see in their lives. Lord, in college, and so many seem to fall away. I just really want and to ask your blessing on this talk, Lord, and this little while talk and discuss just how best to serve you, how to stay faithful through that time, Lord. And just please and help me keep my notes close, Lord, and remember everything I've got to say, and just to talk about what you'd have us to talk about today. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, one quick word of introduction on for the young folks here who are kind of, I guess, over 12, on what's your age as of now? And for any parents who don't have their kids here, what's your oldest kid's age? I just need to tailor a little bit. So just starting this end, I guess.
I am from a family of 10.
Just age.
And I'm 18.
Okay.
That
Okay. Good. Excellent. Okay. I don't know about y'all. Yeah. Okay. Very well. Short introduction then. My name is John Calvin Young. I am a college grad and a Christian. I went to one of the top 3 party schools in the nation, one of the top 15 secular schools in the nation, and one of the most selective colleges in the world, Oxford University in England. I came through all of that, and you guys can too, graduating from a top-flight school with no debts, but more importantly, no regrets, that I think my faith is stronger now than when I entered. That's something which, regretfully, a lot of young folks can't say. I sustained some wounds coming through, but it's entirely possible to survive and even to thrive in even a very secular college environment, even in a highly permissive environment, and come through it with flying colors. So that's just what we're going to talk about a bit today, just what you're going to be facing, how to prepare for it, how to think about it, because that's the big thing, is that a lot of times it's not what you expect to fight that ends up getting you. It's the arrow coming from the wrong direction. And so that's what we're going to talk about a bit. It's just what you need to gear up for, what you need to be ready for, and how you can prepare, even at the very younger ages, what you need to be thinking ahead and getting ready for so that you can fight that fight well when it comes. So I'm just going to dive right in here. Let's see. Just preparation. The big question on everybody's minds is, pardon me, why do so many Christian kids leave the church? How can you stay Christian all through college, even in the most secular and hostile environments you'll likely live through? What do you need to know going into that? The first thing I can tell you is, it's a battleground, stupid. That's the biggest thing that surprised me coming in, was really just not expecting it to be a fight, or not expecting the fight where I found it. That you have to go into this geared up, expecting this world is not your home, and it's going to be a running fight, a guerrilla warfare engagement for the next 4 years going into it. The first point is that you will be tempted and you will have to fight. I knew Christian young folks that would try to seal themselves off and think that somehow if they could maintain a tight enough bubble that it wouldn't get in, it wouldn't affect, and they wouldn't have to deal with it. It doesn't work that way. If you're living in the world, you're going to be in the world, just your task is to not be of it. That doesn't mean you never have contact with it. That doesn't mean you don't know how to face it when it comes. It just means that it doesn't infect you. That you are stronger than all this through the power of your Lord and Savior. And some of those challenges may come, as I said, from the directions you don't expect from other Christians, particularly those who have compromised on key areas. It may not be from your professors at all. It might be from the people who you think are on your side, from the counselors, from the staff, from other people who should be on your side, might be even from your chaplain. You have to be aware that it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a fight on basically every dimension all the way through. Now, the Lord may bless, and it may not be that way in one particular area at one particular time. I ended up for a year abroad in England with the best church group you could ask for as a young person, and had no difficulties with that group at all. But then that year was over. I had to go back to a place where really my greatest competition and my greatest attackers were other Christians. Really sad. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Let's see. Here is one of the most important pieces of thought and thought structure and machinery I can give you. It will be a bubble of alternate reality. It is not reality, but it is real. And what I mean by that is that the rest of the world is not like this. What you may have to deal with, it will come to an end, and you'll be in a different place again. It's usually a whole lot more professional and a whole lot safer to be an adult than the modern college experience. That said, it is real for that duration of time, and you have to learn how to combat it where it stands. So you just have to keep that in mind, that it's that kind of dual tension, that it's not reality as a whole, but you can't discount it because you do have to live through it. Remember, things do have real consequences. One of the best things that helped me get through it, I heard somebody challenge and just mention something back when I was in high school, and it in my mind eventually ended up on a commitment to try to get through college without anything in memory that I can't tell my parents, my future wife, my pastor, my CPA, my lawyer, or my campaign manager. I figure if those are covered, then I'm pretty good. Yeah, if I could tell any of those what happened in college, then I don't have much to fear about somebody looking up my college friends afterwards and asking what I was like in college, or somebody looking up my school records and finding out what happened. Yeah, so just all the bases covered: CPA, pastor, lawyer, campaign manager, parents, and wife. You know, those are just mental structures that'll help you get your minds around this problem to start with. But we're going to move on to some more practical preparation. Choosing your college is a big deal. Let me tell you, a lot of people will give you a default answer saying a Christian college is the only safe option. That's the only way you're going to end up not losing your faith in college. You came and look at a secular school, and so what you do is you just sign up for the best Christian college you can get into, and you're going to be home free. That is not true on either count. To start with, we're going to look at the Christian school issue. I personally did not end up at Christian school. We'll go back into that in a little bit. But I would say at least 50 or 60% of the people I grew up with did end up at Christian schools for college, and those that went to college. And it is no guarantee going to a Christian college of academic success or social safety. The first point is not all those at Christian colleges are Christians. You know, and that sounds very obvious, but it has a lot of implications for your day-to-day life. And one of those is that the rules are there to enforce behavior. They do not enforce minds. They do not enforce hearts. And so what's kind of scary is that a lot of Christian schools function, in fact, as reform schools. That parents send their kids that they are worried about there to make sure that they don't get out of line. And rules can do a fair amount to make sure they don't break things too badly. But that does not mean that the people you're going to be hanging out with, that the general tenor of the conversations and the culture there is going to be beneficial at all. In fact, in some places I've heard horror stories from several Christian schools of extremely negative social circles and things going on under the surface and stuff because it's functioning, well, like a prison does. I mean, it sounds stupid, but you put a bunch of people in one place under strict rules, well, they may or may not break the rules, but that doesn't mean they're not going to stop trying. And that's not to say all Christian schools are that way or everyone at Christian schools are, but that is one element of that picture that you do have to take into account. And now, there are others. I've got great friends up at Grove City in Pennsylvania or Geneva or on Hillsdale or others that intense academic environments full of Christians, full on debating the great things of the faith and everything. That's awesome. That's the sort of high school environment I grew up in. I'm homeschooled with debate team and everything. I loved it, but you just have to realize that it's going to be both, and typically both within a single institution. And here's the counterpoint. You may build a stronger and more intentional faith through being forced to identify with it than in a place where it's easy to be a Christian. That my two schools I went to, Washington Lee, private school up in the mountains, Virginia, long history, mostly Christian history, not explicitly Christian, but it was always staffed and built by gentlemen, and mostly Christian gentlemen. The rules, very intense. You can get kicked out of school for stealing something or for lying, for cheating even on a minor quiz. Upstanding institution, and one which had a strong Christian society, at least by numbers, that probably half the student body went to church semi-regularly, and at least a quarter would identify fairly strongly as Christians. And then I went to Oxford University in the UK, which is pretty Christian by UK standards, but the church in the UK has fallen on some hard times. And they said that Oxford had a great Christian community. It was on roughly 1% of the student body would identify as Christians in any sort of meaningful way or show up to a Christian event. And yet, the Christians I met in Britain were so much stronger for it than most of my friends here that grew up in the Bible Belt nice people always go to church, right? That were Christians on Sunday, on Tuesday nights when Bible study happened, but were worldlings the other 5 days of the week. What happened in the UK was it cost you something socially to say you're a Christian, that you immediately were in that category. And so if you said that, you meant it. And it became part of your identity. It became more important than what your major was or what your fraternity was or something else. It was first, I'm a Christian, I'm a member of CU, which is their InterVarsity, and I go to this church and, oh, I'm at such and such a college. I do this other stuff, you know. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but it's just important to think of that when it's easy, it's way too easy to let it kind of, what's the right word, atrophy, that if you have chapel every day, well, it's pretty meaningless sometimes because that's just something you do all the time. While if you're going to church because you're desperate for respite from the world for a few hours on Thursday night and a few hours on Sunday, that becomes important. And your heart and soul there at the church. So that's just something to think about is that Christian school may be a place and time that's very easy to let yourself go to some degree that when you have the challenges, you're forced to stand up and be counted. And just a note here, a secular school can offer better financial terms than many Christian schools can in the United States, and that particularly the older private schools have great endowments, and right now there's a real move towards no-debt commitments on the part of a lot of these schools, where you come in, and let me tell you, most homeschool families, and by the government calculations, are ragingly poor, just because they don't understand how you can raise kids without providing them each with, you know, a small house of their own in one corner of the building, you know, and all that. And so, basically, documented need is quite high for most homeschool students. And there's many colleges that will say, okay, if you're coming in here, We'll give you merit aid if your scores are great. And if you can, well, you know what? When we put together our financial aid package, we're going to make sure you don't have any loans or you have a very small number of loans. And so even if your scores aren't stratospheric, a top-flight school may be able to offer you a much better financial position, someplace like Davidson, although I don't know much about it. I know that their finances are that way. Or my own school, I think even Duke is going that direction at least, that if you're in, it doesn't matter if you're 25th percentile. If you're the last one in the class, when they make your financial aid package offer, they're not going to be offering you much or any loans. So that's worth a consideration just on sheer financial and points, because getting through college without debt, or even particularly if you can make it through college without having to work 5 extra part-time jobs, will give you a little more of the breathing room you need to maintain stability, to keep your eyes on your classes, to keep your eyes on the Lord through everything, even during final season, and all the rest of that. So it's just something worth considering. So preparation, other things you can do to prepare. Something most college graduates know, that most non-college graduates do not, is that the first few classes freshman year are indoctrination courses. Almost every school That first handful of freshman courses are ones that designed to structure your mind for college in a good way and a bad one. Part of that is your first research courses, the things designed to teach those who didn't spend their high school reading from the library, how to look up a book and how to cite it in your paper and that sort of thing. But also courses about diversity and tolerance and multiculturalism and you know, alternate histories of the 20th century America, you know, and it's designed to give you the structure to think the way they want you to think. And that can be a very disturbing thing. But let me tell you a secret. If you take it in high school, you can usually skip out of most of those courses. If you know the sort of thing you're going to need to take, like every college freshman in the nation has to take freshman English on some level, unless they took something like AP English Literature, AP English Writing in high school, unless they took it through dual enrollment or something. And here's the thing, if you can take these difficult courses like freshman biology, where they hammer origins, by which they mean theory of evolution and none other, on you for 4 or 5 days a week for 15 weeks, if you can take that home, a safe environment where you do study the theory of evolution, you understand why it's a theory, you know, where you can read through the things and read the opposite sources and deal with things on your own turf, it can give you a bulwark. So when you're dealing with important things like how to find the laundry machines and what's it like to budget if you didn't do that in high school, instead of doing those and just being passive in your classes and absorbing all this and having to deal with it when you don't really have time, you will have already dealt with these things and don't have to face these professors who are, in many cases, trying to change your mind and trying to make you something other than what your parents would have liked to see and what you wanted to see. So that's just something you can do that's really going to help you there if you do have the opportunity in high school to take some of those courses ahead. Orientation week. So you've decided on a college, and you show up. And we're going to get back a little more later to deciding on a college and things to ask when you show up on a visit, that sort of thing. But let's say you've already decided on one. You show up for orientation week. Prepare for culture shock. Even the most worldly and the most up-to-date and hip homeschoolers I've known are in a very different world from the modern high school environment. And that first couple of weeks on, and I use this without meaning anything other than it, is like a look into hell. Because you will be faced with a large percentage of what you'll face through your first 4 years, but in concentrated form. Typically administered as all hands activities. So you need to get ready for a week or 2 weeks, or in some cases, up to a term's worth of outright propaganda and brainwashing. It starts here. Grit your teeth, get through it, give noncommittal answers. You know, if they want to ask you about, well, pardon me, your sexual history or your opinion on matters that they're not politically correct, or any number of other things, or if they want details about your family so they can structure what they want to tell you about your family, you don't have to answer it. You don't have to give them a lot of details. You don't have to say everything you believe at every moment. Now, we'll get back to that later, but in certain times, certain battles are not there to fight. They're there where you're not retreating, you're simply flanking position. You're walking around them. And so orientation week is not a time to fight most of the time. It's a time to tune it out as much as you can. Now, I happened to be on painkillers when I went through orientation. I just dislocated my knee and spent it on crutches and nearly hallucinating from massive overdoses of ibuprofen, but that's another story. I heard plenty of horror stories and sat through half of them. And let me tell you, actually, painkillers don't help some of those talks. But just survive. Get through it, because everything changes. Again, at the end of this week. Because when you settle down into your normal class schedule, things will smooth out. It's not going to be that way the next 4 years. And really, do try to not get arrested or do anything you're going to deeply regret that first week. Don't give in. Just fight, grit your teeth and get through it. That's all that's really needed there. Second, prepare for recognition and social acceptance of some truly horrifying things. Just be prepared. Don't embrace them. You don't, just because everyone else is like something, your homeschool should know by this point that doesn't mean you have to be like that. But also, this is critical, don't shy away. Don't be afraid. They cannot touch you. You need to be careful on, and this is really more than anything a word to parents. As your kids are coming through high school, you need to make sure your kids can stand neither falling nor running when confronted with things like homosexuality, alcohol, open fornication, that sort of thing, because they're going to be faced with it. And as I said, there are times to fight, and there's times to move, and there's times to run. They're going to be faced with it on a level that if you start running, you're never going to stop. I knew some kids just got so spooked by it that they couldn't process. I mean, some of them literally couldn't speak to someone that they didn't approve of. It's a crucial part of preparation for adult life that you train them, you give them the structure so that they know how to relate on an entirely business level with people who they do not and cannot approve of. And that's especially critical, as we'll talk later, for having a witness on campus. And that there are times and places to make judgment calls, to speak out against things, sometimes very loudly, and there are times where that is not appropriate and not helpful. So just the big critical thing is to be able, as I said, to stand and not fall nor stampede when faced with a storm. Let's see, housing choices. Let me just say, if possible, get a single room. That's not possible all the time, and it may cost quite a bit more. For that first year in particular, it is entirely worth it. Time enough to get a roommate later when you know who you can trust. It's not worth it getting paired up with somebody who's going to have a different girl in his bed every day, that sort of thing. I had friends that lived through that sort of situation. It's not really good when you get paired up with the drug dealer on the substance-free hall. That guy was special. On the substance-free hall, the cocaine dealer in the corner room, he played his drums at midnight, and his conquest would wander naked and drunk down the hall. That was the substance-free hall. It was one of the quietest halls in the university. Let's see. A bad roommate can make your life a living hell. Again, I'm not using that word lightly. And if to have any hope of concentrating and getting your work done, that sort of thing, and not living in the library, although that's always an option, you really, really want a single room or a trusted roommate if it's at all possible. In fact, if you don't know anyone else going to a university and you have a mandatory roommate, we'll talk about this a little bit more later, hopefully. I'm running long on time so far. Talk to the campus ministers, talk to local Christian groups, and see if they can put you in contact with another Christian kid, because that will be worth whatever trouble, whatever difficulty it is, just to have a safe place to shut the door on the world. That first year, those first year housing is a really miserable experience in many ways, even in the nicest of dorms. So even in the quietest ones. So do weigh carefully, though, if you're going to commuter school, on the differences between living on and off campus. This is something we'll get to a little more later. But even aside from the cost, living in high traffic areas versus low traffic areas can mean the difference between a fairly full, plugged in social life and network versus being an entire nobody. And so, particularly that first year or so, it is on a lower level than safety, but it is still mighty important to make your connections, to figure out who you know, to make those relationships, and it's really hard to do if you disappear from campus at 5 p.m. every day. And I'm saying that from experience, close friends, and my brother living off campus for a while. It can be very rewarding. It's typically better taken for later years. You want to find the best situation you can on campus, but you really do want to be available and plugged in if you want to be involved at all in really anything outside of classes. But there are situations where living at home would be far preferable to the dorm situation at certain schools and whatnot. Just ask a lot of questions, try to figure out, try to balance those. Just be aware that living off is going to have its costs in other ways. Okay, on to academics. I know I'm just throwing you guys through a boot camp here. This is just trying to give you some mental structure, some idea of what you're going to be looking at, and hopefully give you some perspective for how to judge things and how to ask the right questions. For classes, let me tell you, in a class, bar from scripture, be wise as serpents, innocent as doves. That means, among other things, be very careful and decide which traps you're going to try to spring and argue your way through and which ones you're just going to let pass by. Some arguments are not profitable in the middle of class. Some of them are. Some of them are. Just choose your battles. Not everything is a hill to die on. And you don't want a reputation among your professors as a poorly argued fringe opinion. Fringe opinion is fine. You want to be the excellently well-prepared and outspoken fringe opinion when it comes time to fight for those battles. And so you typically don't want to... I mean, there are times when a professor's going to throw something out there and you have to answer. You have to stand up for your faith. But when you have the choice of combating something and not combating something, make sure you're prepared, make sure you're courteous, make sure you can develop your argument and build it up, support it with something beyond just, this is what my parents told me, which is right and true, but that's not sufficient to build the argument. You need to show why you believe it, why you know it to be true. And so be careful about choosing those battles and those arguments. One of my favorite stories on my favorite professor in college, political philosophy professor, brilliant, grew up as a Christian, spent a lot of his adult life as a Christian, spent some time as a monk of all things, and then turned away from that, and is no longer a Christian, although he will admit there are some interesting things to Christianity. Brilliant philosophy professor. And my first class of freshman year was with this man, 8:30 a.m. on the first day of classes, which was after the last big party night of orientation week. So 2/3 of the class was ragingly drunk, which actually does you really good if you show up the first day and you actually have your hair combed and are sitting right way up in your chair. But here's the thing. He was draconianly difficult, as in you show up late, he locks the door, you can't come in late to his class, and if you miss three classes, you fail the class entirely. If your term paper was late at all, you failed the class unconditionally. That sort of thing. You know, special. But he was brilliant, and he would build things, and he could build an argument like few people I've ever met. And most of them were true. Some of them were not. One day, he decided he wanted to make a point about catch-22 situations, about moral quandaries where it was right to do wrong. I had some discussions about that in debate in high school. I knew my ground. I knew the theology, I knew the morality, I knew I had some secular ethics to back it up if he didn't want to accept biblical ethics. I knew the case, so I took the lure and asked him to defend it. And ended up in a 10-minute debate in the middle of the class with 35 people looking on against one of the most feared professors on campus. And round about 90 seconds into it, I'm mentally signing away my grade for that term. I'm thinking, going to fail this class. I am so going to fail my first politics class. I have put my foot in it now. Kept arguing. And the thing was, his argument didn't hold. That there are points beyond which you do not go. And I just called him on it. And he pulls up an example. And the Lord gave me the presence of mind. In the dead draw, he finally called it off. And went on with the rest of the class. And somehow, over the rest of the term, it became markedly evident that I became one of the few students he really respected and liked. And that when I brought my paper in, he invited me to sit down and chat for a while. Later ended up my advisor and wrote me a recommendation for grad school, one of my closest friends on that campus. Because although he did not believe what I did, he respected someone who knew what he was about and could defend his opinions. So few others could. I mean, I recall one famous time when he told on a young lady there that she honestly believed what she had just said, that she ought to quit school immediately and go home because it wasn't going to do her any good. he was not known for tact. But most professors will honestly respect you if you can defend your opinions, defend your beliefs, your convictions, with evidence, with reason, with something beyond just, that's what I was always told, which is what they hear from so many others and so many other Christians. So be the one that has an argument. Be the one that stands up with a reason and courteously calls them on it. Let's see. Get to know... just a sideline. Be a good student. Be prepared. You know, read your materials. Your professors do notice. When you walk into class, sit in the front. This is a secret one of my old professors told me. He said, sit in the front in class. I know it's terrifying. Feels like you're alone up there with the professor. He said,
And he says, breathing down your neck, and I mean, he notices if you get pronounced text somebody. But he said, they notice too. They notice who walks in, who's excited about, enough about the material, sit in the front to dare talk to the professor. And they're the ones whose questions would get answered. They're the ones who are going to get called on. They usually end up with some favoritism towards those ones who will dare to sit in the front. And if you're there, if you hang around 5 minutes after class and ask them a question about the material, you know, if you can befriend your professor, it can pay off in spades.
One of my favorite stories was I was double major. My other advisor, Professor Anderson, incidentally, a Christian who ended up at the same church I did, but I didn't know that when I first took a class from him. He had a class full of juniors and seniors and a few sophomores on that second term of my freshman year, and two homeschool freshmen who are enjoying a 270 level econ class. And it was thrilling. It was international economics. I just come in from a summer a year ago and living in China, working with international businessmen. And so I knew my way around. I was having a field day. Here's the theories to fit everything together. And my good friend Ian was, as I said, sitting across from me. He was the other freshman in the class, and he was the other homeschooler. And so every week, there were these long, dead silences when he wanted questions and no one answered. So we just started asking the questions we had in our minds, which were occasionally more advanced than those the others were asking. And didn't win us too many friends with the other students, but we eventually converted to hanging out with them after class. As soon as everyone else filtered out, we'd be there, and we'd walk him back to his office and pepper him with questions the whole way. And he became a real dear friend to both of us. He ended up on posting my friend to a research grant for 2 summers. He ended up writing me recommendations and giving me advice on grad school and just being a good friend to me. Even when I come back to campus now to visit him, he meets up with me, talks to me at church or over lunch, and just a dear friend. And having a friend, having, as he ended up for a while, the head of the department who's willing to sign off on things and knows that you are a serious student, can get you out of a world of hurt, particularly when you're stuck in a situation with a bad class coming up, with a professor that you don't want to take, that a Christian doesn't want to sit under. There are biased professors out there, or something. A head of department or a senior professor can do you a lot of good. Even the newest professor can do you a lot of good in that situation. So befriend your professors. Be the ones they want to be friends with. And just a side reference, there's a website called ratemyprofessor.com. It's where students go out and write nasty things about the professors, and good ones too. Don't take anything too seriously, because the best professors are usually polemic. Everyone ever either loves or hates them. But you usually see enough to know if someone's going to be the one who doesn't teach but expects you to know everything in the textbook when it comes around for test time, or the one who grades on a ridiculous curve so that even though everyone in her class got 3.7 GPA in high school, that there are D's in her class. That one, you can filter those out. And most colleges, you'll have enough space that you can get to one another of those. You can choose a different professor. I'm going to have to speed up a little bit here. Okay. Subjects and departments. Here's something important. Be skeptical. Don't take anything you're told at face value. Now, that doesn't mean to be the one who's just contrary for contrary's sake, but you don't have to take something as gospel if you hear it in class or if you're told it, and if you're told it by the dean, incidentally, because there are such things as committees on courses and degrees that can change requirements for your degree if need be. I didn't, but one of my best friends did. here's something. Those PhDs are no smarter than you in many cases, and often have equal or less real education. A homeschooled high school student may be as well or better read in the vast body of Western thought and civilization, or in philosophy, or in theology, or in many sciences, even though I wasn't a science student, as many of the professors they're going to sit under. And that's full professors, not even teaching assistants. So you do not have to take what they say as unsubstantiated gospel truth. Call them on it if you have a reason, particularly if you have outside research, which says, do outside research. Few professors love, there are a few things professors love more than the person who takes a reading list and then goes and reads something that's not on the reading list to give it more depth because they were curious about it. Do the outside research, do conflicting research. They don't mind. If you have a topic, figure out what you believe on it and read about it whether it's all straight off the reading list or other things, but get the outside perspective, particularly if you disagree with it, and call them on it. As I said, you don't have to, because they have a PhD after their name does not mean that it's true. Let's see. Ask advice from your parents and your pastors what best to take. Some professors and certain classes may be a very bad bet. Certain classes on American literature or history of Western thought, history of Western civilization, if they're taught by certain people, may not be a topic about what you think at all. American literature easily becomes on gender and race studies in 20th century America. Western thought often takes an Islamicist bent in certain departments, that sort of thing. Ask people who know. You know, it's entirely fair to say, I don't want to take this class, or I'd rather take it from a different section, or something. You don't have to explain why, but you ought to know what the options are, and particularly if somebody's a nightmare class or a nightmare professor, it's good to know that beforehand. You may still have to take it, but at least you'll know. Connected to that, you don't necessarily want to take every subject in a college setting. There's some things that are too difficult and too intense to be able to combat it and keep your part-time job and your other three classes going. I had a situation, actually, with a brilliant class, one of the favorite ones I took in college. There was a class in a secular university from that philosophy professor on, essentially, Athens versus Jerusalem when it comes to philosophy. It was a brilliant class. We read Genesis. And he was fair enough that he challenged everyone. He said, you have to read Genesis like it's fact to understand it, which was an interesting experience for some of those in that class who had never done that before. But in the course of the class, you end up reading some modern philosophy that was intensely disturbing, that the man who wrote it in question had driven himself literally into a sane asylum, straitjacket, insane, in the course of building this theory, that it had broken his reason, end up with electroshock therapy wiping his mind some years later. Robert Pirsig, theoretical philosopher, mid-20th century. But we ended up reading some books by him, and I ended up having to spend, at one point, I realized, I liked this argument in the beginning. It made perfect sense. Now, it seems to contradict Scripture. I have to figure out what's true, or else it's going to cause me real issues. You know, I can set it aside and say, I know Scripture's true, but it's going to be really hard, because I have read this and have enjoyed this argument. I need to figure out what's wrong with it to be able to fit it into my mental space. I spent 3 days on the couch with a book and a Bible, reading and thinking and praying and thinking and thinking and building and taking a 250-page philosophy argument and reconstructing it step by step to figure out where he went wrong. I eventually found out about a third of the way through, he tried to account for something. He tried to account for the origin of something and totally left God out of the equation. And the end result was a self-referential fallacy at the end that will destroy your mind if you try to think about it too much. Literally. It's scary what theoretical philosophy will do if you're not careful when you try to derive the meaning of good, for instance. It's a fascinating topic and one that, connects to everything. So that sort of class, if you have the time, if you have the 3 days to spend on a couch and think about it, can be a lot of fun. Sometimes you don't have it. He had another class the next term. I badly wanted to take it. He's my favorite professor in school. I knew that I was trying to finish my capstone project, and I did not have time to do it in a way that wasn't going to hurt me. And so I didn't take his course. Regret it, but I came through that term and finished my capstone project and didn't have anything left in my head, like a computer virus waiting for me to think about it again. So sometimes you don't have time to take something. Okay, moving on to church. Church is not just marking time, it's a lifeline to the most important things in life, and an anchor and a family for the rough times. Here's the important things about your local church. It's outside of the bubble, usually, off campus, and yet it's usually close enough to the bubble to know what's going on and understand the on-campus frustrations and difficulties. This is crucial. I'll say later, stay in close touch with your parents, stay in close touch with your home church, your home family, but it may be difficult at times because there are things that go on campus. They're specific to campus, to the social atmosphere there or something, which is hard to explain to someone who's not in it. But your local campus minister or something who lives two blocks from the fraternity row and everything and has counseled hundreds of students over the past few years may have some perspective that neither your friend on campus who's living through it nor your pastor back home who's never seen it will have. So having that local church is critical. Even if you've got the best church in the world at home, like I do, you still need that local church. It also can be an excellent source of community, a safe place to openly be a Christian and just not have to worry about flack. It doesn't matter on some level if you're strong enough to shrug it all off. It still hurts. It still takes energy to fight. And so you do need to find those safe places to take a safe harbor, to rest, to find those places that you're not going to have to deal with flack from time to time. Church is also a good place to meet professors, staff, and other good contacts. As I said, I eventually found out that the chair of the math department was a deacon in my church, that the one sometime head of the economics department was a Bible study leader at my church, that so-and-so staff member and the incidentally, the registrar of my college was a churchgoer and knew people I knew, and I could get in contact with them. Those contacts you make at church can help you build relationships on campus with those you see off campus on Sunday. Also, different age brackets. It gives you perspective. I sometimes refer to college students as a lower form of humanity. Really, college students are not a very good social environment for all the time. And frankly, on a college campus, you almost never see anything besides 18, 22, well, if it's a university, 25, 28-year-old young folks, and on 45 to 80-year-old professors. You see almost nobody else. And so having those different age brackets, seeing children around, let me tell you, you think you're annoyed by your little siblings now, but 3 months into college, you're going to discover that not having little ones around means your life is a whole lot poorer. Just having that perspective can help. Seeing families, you know, seeing young families with young children stuff, and you're caught up in all the hustle and bustle and the social worry about whether you've got a girlfriend this week or whatever, that can be really helpful just to see there's life after this, there's a different world out there. It can give you the perspective you need to make it through the latest battle. You may be able to find a surrogate family, someone who will kind of adopt you for the year. A lot of churches do that. I didn't have it at home in Virginia, although some of my other friends did. But when I was in England, a local family that had a son about my age adopted me for the year, and they put me up from time to time. We'd go out to his house away from college, and his family would feed me for a night and let me stay over and have movie nights and hangouts and stuff. And his family ended up hosting a goodbye party when I left. And when I went back, for a visit this year, they said, "Oh, you have to come, and we'll feed you dinner, and you'll stay with Simon again." And those families, they really can be your alternate family for those months and years you're away. And church is typically where you're going to find that. Your church is also an outlet for ministry, both to others your age and in the broader community. It's very important to remember that there's life beyond the college campus, and therefore you really do need You can take some of that time and energy you have and pour it into ministering to others outside of just the student community. But then you can also, in your local church, get involved in the student ministry, particularly as an older student, the things that helped you get through your first year. You know, don't discount the importance of just giving somebody a ride to church, particularly if the best churches are a little ways away from campus. I ended up falling into a little minor ministry of just picking up freshmen. Every Sunday I had a big four-door sedan, so I just roll up at 12 minutes to the hour or whatever on Sunday mornings and end up with a carload. Four folks in the back. I knew a guy who had a big pickup who'd end up with a whole bed full. But we just drive the mile and a half church, because let me tell you, when you're tired and you're a college student, that mile and a half can look like a long way. And saving someone that mile and a half walk for 10 Sundays in that first fall may save those next few years their life. May not make a difference their internal salvation. The Lord may bring them back, but may make the difference as to whether they stay close to the Lord for the next few years or not. And I've been told by others that I had the honor of being part of that, and keeping people close to the Lord and close to what they grew up in for those first few crucial months. Don't discount the importance of even just a small thing like that. Now you have the other option, on-campus Christian organizations, which I was heavily involved in and highly recommend, but not as a substitute for your church off campus. As opposed to church, they are right there, they're inescapably part of campus, and they offer high, high accountability. That who you see there will see you in your dorms, will see you on Friday night, will see you wandering into the dining hall on Saturday morning, hopefully not hungover like all your other peers, that sort of thing. So high accountability there. That said, they're really easy to switch on and off to some degree because it's really easy just, I'm headed somewhere and, I happen to show up at a Bible study this night of the week. It's really easy to become a two-day Christian. As you said, the Christian who's in church on Sunday morning and shows up for a large group on Thursday night and the other five nights of the week lives like everyone else. And so in some ways you need the greater challenge of those who are living the full Christian life off campus to remind you of what that means. It's not just in showing up for a few meetings. It can be a low-time logistic commitment compared to church, which means it's often fairly easy to take on in addition to church, to show up for that Bible study on campus once a week or something, short walk. That said, if you end up in leadership, it may end up being a very high time and logistic commitment. There's some differences between denominational and non-denominational groups, particularly if you're in a fairly strong church body, you may want to see if the campus you're looking at, and this is something that feeds into that decision, which campus, on whether they have associated group, like Presbyterians have Reformed University Fellowship, Baptist Student Union. You ask around about the different groups because some of them may be strong and some not. I ended up in RUF, even though I've only attended Presbyterian Church for those 3 years that I was in Virginia, because that was the closest in tone and in strength to the sort of body I grew up in. Non-denominational groups can be a little more hit or miss. Sometimes they can be stronger on a small campus because they can reach and draw in people from all sorts of backgrounds. But they can also sometimes, regretfully, be a little bit flaky on theology because they don't have a doctrinal statement, don't have an ordained minister associated with it. A denominational organization, for instance, is often associated with the local church assembly on off-campus, too, so they can, in some ways, are a bit of a one-stop shop. You see the same people both there on Tuesday nights and Sunday mornings. But non-denominational ones can be really strong, and it all depends on the campus. On the same organization on different campuses can be wildly different. And so ask around, figure out what's the best one to attend there. I ended up attending too. RUF on Reformed University Fellowship and the InterVarsity chapter. Loved it. I had other friends at other colleges where on Baptist Student Union was the option. That was the one you went to if you were a serious Christian. On certain groups will become known for being the one where non-serious Christians hang out with. Guess what? That's probably not the one you want. That sort of thing. So just ask around, ask questions, visit them all if you can, anyone that's near what you would be involved in. And sometimes you'll end up surprised, like being involved with a bunch of Anglicans in England that nevertheless were closer to why I actually believed in a historic ancient church that's been reformed and serious evangelical for centuries than in most modern Baptist or Presbyterian churches like the ones I attended in the States. That was Anglican. That was a bit of a surprise. But ask those questions. Judge based on what they're like, not the labels. Let's see. Campus ministers are a critical resource. They aren't all youth ministers. Most of them are a lot more serious, particularly denominational ones, maybe ordained ministers of the same sort of background as your own pastor, or better. In some cases, I sat under one for a long time who had been to Westminster Theological Seminary. I sat under a non-ordained one who went to Duke University in Oxford. Go figure. Academic heavyweight, that one. So they can be a lot more help than your average youth minister might be if you have one of those in your church at home. Let's see. In their visibility on campus, they offer a big opportunity for public ministry and outreach in those organizations. It's easy to invite your friends to one night a week. Easy entry for that. It's also easy exit if somebody just stops coming. So there really does need to be a drive from less to more commitment to more community. If they offer a Bible study or cell group, go and try it out. That may be where the real discipleship happens. That may be where that deeper community comes. And that may end up your surrogate family, like it was for me. Man group, as they called it, the men's Bible study. A bunch of 20-something guys who just love the Lord and knew how to have a good time, too, without getting in trouble. And so we'd host things like guns, fire, meat, a big party where we went skeet shooting and then barbecued things, putting on the Christmas bonfire for the girls' groups, that sort of thing. You can find your family sometimes in those groups. And as I said, with the high visibility of those groups, it can help provide a primary identification on campus. Who you are and what does that mean to the rest of campus. I am aware I'm running out of time. If you guys are good, I'm going to keep going for a little while because we've got a window before the next talk. So if everybody's good, sorry, I've got a lot of information here. It's hard to get through it all in time. Okay, so I said that primary identification is important, and we're going to get to that a little more under friends, social life, which is the next bit. When you're looking for friends, look for those whose primary identity and their outward persona, just who you meet, who you hear about first, is that of a Christian. Be a Christian first, an engineer, or Sigma Delta, or the valedictorian, or the track star second. That is so important, and that was something which I really noticed in that difference between those two universities. That the one US, I knew so many people who were a Phi Delt who went to RUF, who were a med student who showed up for InterVarsity. And then in England, in a far more cliquish and far more socially difficult environment, I met the Christians who went to such and such a church, and oh, we're at Balliol, a college that, well, I'm just celebrated 750th anniversary last night. Or the other ones who went to the same church, they were a Christian, and that was the important thing. They've talked to me and found out that they were from, and, you know nothing backgrounds, their parents didn't even go to university, you know. So that's the important bit. That's the important bit, is what that identification is. That when you've got friends, when you ask who they are, you find out first what church they go to. And what Bible studies they attend, and then they mention their major and what they want to do after college, then you know you've got some real people. Let's see. Here's something to be careful of, though, and something to be very aware of, and this is heartbreaking that I have to tell you this. But you may face condemnation and backlash from other Christians. Particularly in a modern college environment, there are many, many Christians who have compromised in massive fashion, and they will tend to fight and lash back at those who have not conceded, who have not fallen to the same temptations they have. It may be very bitter. Be wary. And to quote Rudyard Kipling, I love this line from If, let all men count with you, but none too much. I know I had some close friends I really respect in the Christian community. I didn't realize what was there on sacred cow, so to speak. And tripped over a couple of it and ended up getting excoriated by some people who counted with me too much, who I considered like older brothers. And it took me about a year to recover from it, and recover my confidence, because I just felt like I'd been blown away by the bitterness and the backlash from them. Or even situations where you've done something, perhaps offended somebody, but their reaction is not Christian, not just, not reasonable, can end up being far too much of an influence on you. And so, as I said, let all men count with you, but none too much. Let's see, it's not necessarily anything you say or do, though, even if they allege an offense, that the Holy Spirit working on others' hearts and others' minds, using your example, even though you never say anything, can mean that people end up very bitter towards you. And this can be hard, particularly when you're trying really hard not to offend. And that's why the crucial thing is not to try not to offend. Just try to live the life that the Lord has called you to, and let the chips fall where it may. Or, instead of condemnation, you may experience just quiet pressure. Just a little bit of pressure over a long time can bend a tree, can steer a ship, can change a heart. And this can feel less like pressure and more like success. Let me tell you, that is something very deceptive and insidious. Watch the company you keep. Watch the people you hang out with. If you start making too many excuses for them, start thinking about that. Take note of it and try to figure out why. Because it's way too easy for it to look like success and social acceptance. I'm finally part of this group. And the craving, and C.S. Lewis talked about that eternal desire to be in the inner ring, to be in the inner circle. And sometimes, even among good Christian folk, you can end up being subtly changed by that. So just be careful. And I say, if you start making excuses for your friends a few times too many, you might want to look at it and figure out whether it's your friends or whether it's something else. Let me see. Avoid both condemnation and quiet pressure. But be careful about burning your bridges. Let me tell you, you may struggle about whether to call out sin or not when you see it. I told you I'd bring this back up. If you don't have a relationship with the people in question, it will rarely help the situation, and it may worsen it. That is something that was very difficult for me to figure out. In high school, I was a very black and white kid. I'd grown up in a strong, philosophical, theologically oriented family. I knew what was truth and what was error. I knew what was right and what was wrong. And, I mean, I had my things which I was not great on, but I at least knew where the line was. And it made me so mad when I saw people in college who obviously rejected the lines that God put there and were running over them left and right. And I was right on most of those judgments. I'm not trying to say that it's wrong to understand that there are right and wrong. However, there are times where you can call something out and make a big deal about it and bring it up with somebody and change their heart through the Lord's help. And there are times when it's not going to do any good and is, in fact, going to ruin your relationship with them. So be very careful. And sometimes you can't do anything about it. I had a situation where a good friend of mine, a girl wanted to share a lot of the struggle she was dealing with that she had decided she was homosexual and was going through a lot of pressure about that. And I felt I had truthfully to tell her, I sympathize, I love you for who you are. That said, I'm not saying that I approve of this behavior at all. This is unconditional. You know, don't think that I approve of what you're saying by the fact that I'm sitting here listening to it. Didn't say it quite like that. That said, ended up really shaking that up, and she really didn't want to hear anything else from me after that point. That wasn't my fault. I said, I said what I felt the Lord absolutely had to say to preserve truth in a relationship, and the way that happened ended up taking that relationship away from me. That said, remember that Christ ate with publicans and tax collectors, and you can too. If the sin involved is not something that is tempting you, leading you astray, or destroying your witness with other people, then you may be able to have a strong witness yourself just by living a holy life around them. And this particularly applies for the inescapable things, things like the pervasive alcohol use at most universities. Yeah, if you're like one friend of mine who would basically flip out anytime anybody so much as mentioned alcohol and fled the scene, he was just laughed at away as an absolute quack. It made a lot more difference to them when myself and a couple other good friends stayed in their circles, stayed in their friends, went to a lot of the same events, and seemed to have just as much good time as they did and never drank a drop. And never had a blackout night where we didn't remember what happened because we'd been too drunk. You know, and that made a much bigger influence on people than flipping out and leaving did. And so, you know, if it's something I just said that's not tempting you and leading you astray or just absolutely destroying your witness among others, then staying in their society and in their friendship may help you have a strong influence on them. Here's some more advice. Don't get desperate for a relationship. Colleges, particularly secular ones, I'm going to use an illustration from a book I read a while back, a novel, and they're full of fetal men and women. They're larval. They're not yet grown. They're still very much in an infant stage. Even the Christians. This is not a big deal if you're also terminally immature, the way a lot of my friends were. But for most homeschool grads, that means that the actual pool of good matches in a college environment may be extremely small, even among the other Christians. And so watch out for the good ones, but recognize also, I feel like I made some mistakes in that I just assumed that that all my friends at home were probably going to change, and I was probably going to change too, and therefore almost certainly I was going to find and get married to somebody I knew in college. And so I put a lot of effort and a lot of emotion into hoping to find the right one in college. And that didn't happen. I ended up figuring out, really, that there were only two or three others, probably in that entire 4 years, who I knew who were on the same track that I was, with the same sort of convictions. And none of those were the ones that either one of us was being led to do anything about. So, you know, take that pressure off yourself. Watch out for those good ones. You might find your one in college, like my parents did, but recognize that the possibilities will likely be much narrower than you might have thought when you were in high school. That it might be after college or might be back home or something, and you find the one. So just take that pressure off yourself. Let's see. Fraternities, Greek life, and other public social outlets like that. Let me tell you, I'm going to make this quick because I don't have a ton of time, but be very careful if encouraged to join them. My U.S. university is probably the most Greek on the frattiest, as they would say, college in America. Around 85% of guys and 75% of women are in Greek organizations, which is double to triple what most of the universities, the strong Greek life, are like. And it's basically assumed that if you are not an absolute cave troll, as we sometimes refer to them, who stay in the room all the time, you would join one of these organizations at a not inconsiderable financial cost and just go along with everything, because that's just what you did. Most of social life was centered around them. They're idealized on campus, usually. You hear a lot about leadership potential and friendship and brotherhood and all this sort of thing. You'll almost never hear about the dark side. I will say to parents, fraternities are not all created equal. Don't freak out if your kid ends up considering joining one. However, ask a lot of questions. To the youth, you don't know everything, and once in, you will face far higher rejection leaving than if you're never part of it in the first place. And so you need to ask a lot of questions, you need to consider very carefully whether you ever join an organization like these. One big thing to think about is you cannot control what your brothers or your sisters do and what you will be expected to by organization rules to stand by, watch, and even help with. And so you can end up in some morally very questionable situations, even if you're not doing anything wrong, because you're required to stand by and watch while someone else does something unspeakable. And so be very careful, very cautious. Think about that, even. Can you be blood brothers, basically, with everyone in this organization, everyone that may join in the next 4 years? That is a very important thing to think about. Here's something just to watch out for. Homeschoolers are often very socially open, that most have never been hurt in the way that most public school students have in the course of middle school and high school, yet they're not particularly adept in the dog-eat-dog world of college social groups. Many college students really haven't left middle school yet, and it'll be subtler than on the movie Mean Girls, if anybody's ever seen that. It was fairly blatant in that movie, and in a lot of middle school life, just kind of the who's in, who's out, who's up in a clique, who's not. It becomes a whole lot more subtle, a whole lot under the surface, a lot more sophisticated level of ostracization and everything in college and blacklisting, which happens, all these things. So be careful. The world is changing, but the colleges aren't entirely there yet. It's become almost socially acceptable to be a nerd these days, to love learning, to love reading, to love knowing things. And yet, in college, that may not be, and that may give you issues. You know, be who you're supposed to be, just be aware that to have good grades may be acceptable, but to be an intellectual, to actually love it, may not be. You know, I talked to the son of an oil baron, who was a Bible study leader and a good guy and got consistent on A's and B's in his classes. And if you wanted to bring up a topic from class, even philosophy and theology or something, on Sunday night, he'd blow up at you. That he's not that sort of person who'd talk about a class out of class. It's really weird. Just get used to it. But be aware that that may feed into some of your relationships and some of the things you have to deal with. You may have to make your own fun to some degree. Let me tell you, if there's not a group for what you want to do, start one. Colleges are often designed to foster this sort of thing. And so if you end up starting a group, you might end up with college funding for it. You might end up with 50 kids doing it every Friday night, like some of my friends did when they started a little organization they called it first just something like People Who Love Fun. The goal was an alternative to a drinking party. And they ended up eventually getting a reservation with campus to reserve one of the classroom buildings on any evening they chose from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. to play games in, to have events, to play like we did on full-scale live-action on Mafia on over three stories of blacked-out building. That was fun, also a little dangerous. But all things that were clean and relatively safe and definitely not the sort of thing you're going to have moral issues about. And it all started because a bunch of kids thought, hey, this would be fun if we don't do like everyone else does. And then it ended up with like 80 people involved. So sometimes you have to be that one, that seedling to start it, the catalyst, or the seed in the oyster shell that keeps annoying people until you get what you want. It can get smoothed over. So don't be afraid to do uncool things. If you do what you want to do, you may find your closest friends there doing them with you. So that's something fun, whether that's singing in the choir, or going on long hikes, or playing hide and go seek in a blacked out classroom building at 1 a.m. It's a lot of fun. Remember what your parents taught you about dares. Social dares, the sort of challenges, the see if you can do this like everyone else does, even if it's not verbalized, is just as dangerous as a personal dare. I double dog dare you to do that sort of thing. Stay away from them. You don't need to take the bait. Even if that's a social level bait of just an expectation that everyone goes through this, everyone goes through hazing and joins a fraternity because that's just what you do. You can say no. You can find a different way. Outflank them. Walk around them. Don't let acceptance drive you, nor rejection. Just back to what I said, you know, let all men count with you, but none too much. To be driven by that desire to be an inner ring is so, so dangerous because I have seen people been absolutely twisted like a corkscrew because they started and said, well, we'll change a little bit to fit in here, a little bit there to fit in here, a little bit there to fit in here, and they end up in the end an absolutely shadow of what they originally were because they kept changing just a little bit at a time, and gave to that and got drawn just through life by that desire to always be. Let me tell you, even if you make the inner ring, there's a ring beyond that, and a ring beyond that, a ring beyond that, and sometimes you're going to be in the inner ring. It's going to be really pleasant. You can be a charter member of something or be among the friends of the conductor in the choir or something. But don't let it drive you. Don't let that become what it's about. Just like you shouldn't let your academics drive you. What's important is living through this and learning what you need to learn. Not numbers on a page. Not the number of people that know your name on campus. These are all good things, but they aren't the best thing. Remember in your social interactions, you're more mature than most. And your willingness and ability to talk with many different ages, personality types, social strata is a plus, not a minus. In my second year of college, I had considered joining a fraternity and ended up not joining one. And basically ended up blackballed from campus social events for a few months, which was pretty painful. I didn't realize that, yeah, for the second half of the year, if you weren't in a Greek organization, you basically hung out with yourself. Because there wasn't anything else happening that wasn't tied up in a Greek organization. Pretty scary few months. Second year, I didn't want the other freshmen who are making similar decisions to go through that. So with on the advice and goading of my campus minister, put together a dinner at my house that first week and invited everyone I knew who wasn't involved in what everyone else was doing. Turned into a weekly, bi-weekly sort of thing that continued through the rest of that year and picked up again my senior year when I got back from England. Came real ministry because after that first few weeks, ended up drawing in others. People that I knew, that I just talked to, that I found interesting and never even thought to check whether they were in a social group that didn't talk with people like me. And ended up with a network my campus minister told me, said, I've never known anybody who has as good a network across this campus as you do. He said, I don't know that many people. He said, you know someone in every fraternity. I said, well, yeah. He said, most people don't. You don't understand that fraternity only dates those three sororities at the top, none of the others, and if you're more than three places below them in the fraternity hierarchy, they don't talk to you of those. You know three. I said, yeah, but there were guys I knew from freshman year and talked to them. I said, no. You've got all these connections, use them, talk to them. Bring people together, bring these circles together that don't talk. You've got those connections, use them. As a homeschooler, you're going to form those connections a whole lot easier than most people will. Be real. Few things are in as short supply on a college campus as real people. So just be honest, be open. In a Bible study, you know what? Sometimes it's okay to talk about what you're struggling about. And people respect you more for seeing. I invited one of my closest friends who's a non-Christian to a Bible study. And I got so scared because when he showed up, I saw one of the other guys who showed up occasionally. I knew that guy had a laundry list of issues, some legitimate, some not. And he always wouldn't talk about them. Always kind of made me feel uncomfortable inside and slightly sick. And he was in fine form that night. He went on for about 5-10 minutes on prayer request time about everything in his life he's struggling with and wants prayer for. And he's thinking, oh man, Scott is so going to hate this. Scott, he's not going to deal with this. He's never going to want to come back. And we walk out that evening after a solid time of prayer. Said, and even before I had the chance to ask Scott, what do you think? He said, well, that was fun. I might come back next week. I did a double take and said, well, what'd you like? I'm thinking, I mean, the talk wasn't that good tonight, and the man prayer request time was awkward. And he said, I mean, it's just, everyone was real. So, I mean, everybody's talking about what they're dealing with, and just they're willing to be honest and open, and they're real. They're real guys. I think I really like them. Wow. wow, that was just a lightning bolt. It's like, don't be like everyone else. We used to say that everyone's fine at Washington Lee because you could ask somebody, it didn't matter. They just washed their face after spending 15 minutes crying because of that sorority girl that cut them, you know, or they're dealing with major issues at home, or they're dealing with the consequences of that night out partying, and they're on the suspension list for next term, and they don't dare tell anybody because everyone is fine. Always be real, just be yourself. Just tell them what's up. Tell them when it's good. Tell them when it's down. And tell them when it's the Lord that's getting you through it, and it will have immense influence. Few short more things. I know we're running smack out of time. Personal life. Ignore social boundaries. They can't do anything to you. And I touched on that. But ultimately, nearly all the social struggles on campus are empty, fighting for meaningless pride of place. It's a ranking exercise. You know, I saw a joke one time in a comic strip. Someone said he was doing research in sociology and said, my latest project is in ranking people from best to worst. Ha ha. That's college campus, honestly. Most social environments on college campus have this heavy undercurrent of just defining pecking order. And ultimately, it's all meaningless. So you can walk around them, outflank them, get out of it. I know we're running out of time. Show Christ's love to marginalized people, to the others on the fringes, particularly if you've known that feeling. Reach out to them, love them, hold them, listen to them. You have a critical tension in how much you invest of your time on campus. Point one, on this side. Escape the bubble. It's critical. Just get out of town, get off campus, away from the other students, go home, go visit friends, go for a hike, walk off down a trail and don't come back for an hour. Get out of the bubble and give your brain and mind and heart time to reset the real world and what you know best. On the other hand, don't leave too often, particularly on the weekends. And this goes for double if you're on a commuter campus. After a certain point, if you're gone enough, you're ensuring that nothing you do is going to make it any better because you're not there enough to count. One of my good friends, it's a careful balance tip, one of my good friends, strong Christian, but she hated it the first year at college. And it got to where every time her family traveled to the area or came to town on a parents' weekend, they wouldn't come to campus and meet her professors and meet the other students that were part of her life. She would meet them off campus and they would go off for a weekend. She always came back refreshed, but ultimately she had a lot less a connection to those around her because she didn't make those relationships in the off hours, in the parents' weekend times. Okay. Make sure you get your downtime. Invest that time in your relationship with the Lord. You won't regret it. Your intellectual and physical health is intimately linked to your spiritual health. I never had worse grades than when I was depressed and not spending time with the Lord. Don't let yourself stagnate, particularly if you're from a strong church and a strong environment at home. You may be used to...
It's 119. Mm-hmm.
Aware of it. Watching it. We're going to be done in just a couple minutes. You may be used to a far swifter atmosphere at home, in your home church or something, you may have to supplement what's considered enough at college just to keep yourself up to that level. That may mean you go to church and you go to Bible study, and then you go to another Bible study, and then you do some reading on your own just to keep your spirit up and going and get enough food, you know, that sort of thing. Keep your lines of communication open with your parents, with your pastors, and with your friends back home. It's far too easy to let those prevailing winds, you know, a prevailing wind means a wind that blows all the time for a certain direction, shape you, bend your thinking subtly over time. Beware the drift and check against it often. Check back home. Ask your friends, you know, are you changing? What's changing? You know, you're going to change in college, but you want to make sure it's not on anything core. And then invest in and know the difference between an inner and an outer circle. The inner circle is tried and true friends, Christians all, Christians you can trust. Those are the ones who you're safe with. You can let down your hair, so to speak. You can trust. You can let count with you. Yet you cannot live there all the time. You have to live out in the world, too. You have to interact with others. And so the outer circle is reaching out. You reach out, draw in, open up, have a wider circle of influence. Being real and happy and uncowled as a Christian can do wonders for others. Even we can struggle in Christians or non-Christians. For the unsaved around you, live out your faith in front of them. But know who you can confide in and who you shouldn't listen to if they have criticisms. There's a difference there between those types of friends. Okay, finally, conclusion. Just going to give you on 6 or 7 points here. One, victory is possible. Believe it. Two, temptation will be other than you expect, but you can survive in the strength of the Lord. C, Getting plugged in early and often with Christian community on campus and the local church will give you the stability, the breathing room, and the encouragement to keep fighting. D. Academics are a challenge, but you needn't fear them. Remember, you have the answers. Your professors may not. Don't feel bad about disagreeing with them. E. Invest in close Christian friends and reach out to a wider circle of non-Christians. F. Show grace and love and merciful righteousness to your fellows through your life. Just being a real Christian, neither running from them nor compromising, is an incredible witness and challenge. Become friends with all, reach out to them, and the Lord will give you opportunities to share your faith through those relationships, to be able to give a defense for the hope that's within you when someone asks. G. Keep your lines of communication open with your pastor, your parents, and your God. These will be crucial to maintaining your balance and strength. And just finally, I'm going to leave you with this. Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the full armor of God so that you'll be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you'll be able to resist in the evil day, having done everything to stand firm. Thank you very much.